representing the entire city. This is BCFM. BCFM 98.
Getting Bristol home.
This country's had a secret foreign policy ever since the end of the Second World War. And one of the essential instruments has been the Central Intelligence Agency. In other words, we've had presidents, every president since Truman has made great moral pronouncements. But the CIA has been the instrument they have used, actually, too consistently, and in every part of the world. This is interesting. It's not only in third world countries. The first CIA operations were in Europe.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Is the whole story about Middle East terrorists in Europe just a big racist lie made up by MI5 and London Police Counter-Terrorism Command? As an excuse for war and more money for MI5 and the police, and if it were a lie, who would dare to say so? Well, charged with keeping London's financial district safe from terrorists, and with this week's announcement of a doubling of armed anti-terror officers patrolling the streets of the capital, wouldn't you have hoped the City of London Police Counter-Terrorism Command were up to the job? But what if they were fitting innocent Londoners up as terrorists to justify their existence, or using the veil of national security to take bungs from private security firms, to lie in court and to burgle victims' homes when they got found out? Well, this is what happened and came out in court to plumbing firm boss Ian Puddick when he telephoned a powerful city firm asking for his wife to be moved from working with a manager who'd been having an affair with her. Suddenly, he was a terrorist. His home was illegally raided in a bout of police bribery and corruption that nearly destroyed his business. It's taken Ian Puddick years to fight back against the crooks at the Counter-Terrorism Command and the gang of criminal masterminds, a private security firm called Kroll. And Bristol's good old super-rich elite merchant venturers, owning and running utility companies, hospitals, youth services, our schools, and Mayor George Ferguson was a merchant venturer too. Have they taken over? Plus Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. I think that's where we'll start, Martin. Is anywhere you'd like to point to this week? Obviously, we had a terrorist attack of some kind in Ankara and also in Jakarta this week.
Yes, I mean, it's ongoing. I mean, when these attacks occur, people can't presume that they know exactly what's going on.
Well, funnily enough, the Turkish police seem to identify almost immediately that the attacker was a Saudi or a Syrian who'd come through Syria.
But then they claim that they were Russians. If you saw the follow-up, they then arrested three Russian nationals. So, in other words, it's a game of mirrors, and you can never be quite sure what's happened. What we do know, for example, in Indonesia, the Bali bombing, that Kopassus, who are connected to the Indonesian security forces, have a track record of going around blowing things up and pretending to be Islamists, as do MIT in Turkey. Most Western...
Sorry, who are MIT?
The military intelligence, which is the Turkish secret police. There's a track record of the military, which are both Western-aligned militaries. The Indonesian military took power in Indonesia in 1964, in a military coup backed by Britain and the US, in which a million people were put to death by the incoming military government. And that military is the same military which General Wiranto used to head it up. And they've got a track record of actually creating terrorist incidents and then using them to try and cement support for the regime. So in Indonesia and Turkey, both Western-aligned militaries, they've got a track record of creating terrorist incidents in order to create certain political effects. But of course, the way in which the Western media presents this is, oh yes, that must be ISIS again. Now, ISIS, of course, many people who were very serious researchers and military intelligence officers for the Russians and the Iranians and so on, they're fairly clear about where these ISIS-aligned groups have actually come from. They've actually come from Western military intelligence working with the Gulf Cooperation Council states. I don't think there's any doubt about that amongst those who are serious observers.
Well, there certainly is a lot of doubt about it, Martin, certainly at the Pentagon, for example.
Well, no, they're all over the place. Did you see Seymour Hersh, a very senior journalist, probably the senior journalist in the United States, again has written another devastating article in the London Review of Books, where because he's got very good contacts on the inside of the US military, and he said that Martin Dempsey, who used to head up the US armed forces, without telling Obama, was passing Assad technical intelligence via third parties to help him defeat ISIS. But that was actually, Dempsey has now been moved aside, and Dunford has now been put in charge of the US Armed Forces because he's on side with keeping, not playing footsie with Assad under the table. Now, in other words, pretty much everybody who follows these things, including the Russian general staff and the Iranian general staff, people say, oh, the Russian and Iranian general staff, who are they? Well, I just say it's their job to know who's doing stuff. It's just like it's the job of, supposedly the job of the British Armed Forces to know who's doing stuff.
Why would the US military be actually helping Assad while their official foreign policy is actually
because the
regime change?
The tension is between the US military, who basically interpret the, you know, that this is, you know, I think what Dempsey was saying to the politicians is, look, this is a bit silly, we need to calm down. When Admiral Fallon was in charge of CENTCOM, some years ago, after the first Iraq, the 2003 Iraq war, he basically made public statements saying, we are not going to attack Iran, we have no intention of attacking Iran, everybody in Iran calm down, it's not going to happen. Meanwhile, the politicians back in the US were, you know, beating the drum for war. So, in a sense, this is a kind of, it's a chink through the curtain, and we can see what's going on behind the scenes. But I think all serious military intelligence analysis is absolutely clear that ISIS is a creation of the Saudis, the Turks, the Qataris, and their backers, Britain and the United States.
Well, I made the point earlier this week that there's this big similarity, isn't there, between these public beheadings that the Saudis do and ISIS do. But the Saudis, I think it was yesterday actually, announced that anybody, any blogger or on Twitter, any Saudi citizen that compared the judicial system of Saudi Arabia to the ISIS would be arrested.
Well, I think possibly the difference between ISIS beheadings and Saudi beheadings, in the Saudi beheadings are real, they really behead people, whereas many of the so-called ISIS beheadings are videos which claim to be beheadings and aren't. And actually, all these videos are uploaded by Rita Katz's website, searching the internet for terrorist entities.
Yeah.
And Rita Katz is an ex-Israeli intelligence officer.
Well, she's based in
Langley, Virginia, yeah, home of
actually,
the CIA.
It's Bethesda, Maryland,
right,
which is just around the corner from the National Security Agency.
Well, indeed. And this is where, and this is where these ISIS videos, which are supposedly ISIS videos, that's their usual place where they first appear, is on Rita Katz's website, who is a known intelligence operative
for the
Americans and the Israelis.
As the media churn this stuff out on our nightly news, why aren't they telling us your actual origin and making questions about who is producing these? I noticed one of the recent ones was incredible production values, high definition, etc., which you wouldn't necessarily expect from a bunch of renegades.
No, you wouldn't, would you? And in actual fact, there are too many question marks underlying all of this.
I remember with Bin Laden, the CIA actually admitted they were fabricating Bin Laden videos.
Indeed. Now, in other words, they've got a track record of, and don't forget, Al-Qaeda was set up by CIA, MI6, in the 1980s, during the Thatcher-Reagan era. British officers armed and trained them in the first place. And the story is that they then went rogue, and then we lost control of them.
Okay, so what's going on in Istanbul? What's going on in Turkey?
Well, there's a war going on in Turkey now between the PKK, which represents, you know, the Kurdish minority, which is a big minority, 14-15% of the population concentrated in the southeast of the country. They've started to attack the HDP, which is the the open democratic political party representing the Kurds. They're under heavy attack. Hundreds of people have been killed in sweeps by the Turkish army through Diyarbakir and other Kurdish towns in the east of the country.
Some journalists have been killed, haven't they? Particularly academics and journalists being arrested, many journalists being sacked, etc.
Well, they're using air power as well. So isn't it time for NATO to put in a no-fly zone to stop the Turkish army from killing this minority? Oh, we're part of NATO. Oh, goodness, their pilots are trained by us. Oh, goodness me. Now, of course, what's actually happening is most people are being fed a line about Islamist terrorism in the Middle East, but they're not being told the truth, which is that Islamist terrorism is by and large being orchestrated by Western intelligence services. Well, but I tell you who is telling them the truth, the Russian general staff, who've got their people on the ground fighting ISIS, rather than training them like we're doing.
ISIS claims credit for a Paris-style Jakarta attack as well this week.
Well,
what's the sort of political background of Indonesia and Jakarta then?
Well, Indonesia is a very big and important country, but as I explained earlier, there was a military coup in Indonesia to prevent a sort of nationalist government coming to power.
Which was organised by
the CIA.
The Bilderberg, well, I would say actually almost personally by Henry Kissinger.
Indeed, and a million people lost their lives in that military coup. They went round and rounded up the whole of everybody they thought represented the Indonesian Communist Party, mostly, and they were all executed in huge batches. And eventually you got a semi-democratic regime in Indonesia, but one of the former presidents of Indonesia, whose name begins with W but it's now escaped me, but he was quite clear, everybody knows in Indonesia and in Turkey, whatever part of the political spectrum they come from, that terrorist attacks are orchestrated by the security services and then pinned on the people that they want to pin them on. And it's just common knowledge. So the whole war in Turkey between the PKK and the Turkish government had been in abeyance for several years. But after the Suruk bombing, which killed 30-odd PKK or Kurdish political activists, the PKK immediately recognised that was being carried out by the Turkish state, identified two Turkish intelligence officers they thought were behind the bombing, assassinated them, and that broke the ceasefire. Now, most people in Britain do not get this at all.
But I mean, just a minute. Erdogan is very firmly in power. He's just had a general election and won it.
Yes, he did. He did win. Is that the idea that Erdogan's got no support is wrong. But he's got no support in southeast Turkey. It's like if the British Conservative Party tries to stand in Ireland, they're not going to get anybody elected. And that's because Kurdistan is not necessarily Turkey. Just like Kosovo is not necessarily Serbia.
Let me drag you back to Jakarta, to Indonesia, halfway across the world. Why might there be terrorist attacks going on there? Give us a bit of the background. Well, we did do quite a good, if people would like to cycle back a few episodes before Christmas, I interviewed Bilveer Singh from Singapore, a political scientist, about the general picture there. And obviously Indonesia has been a big centre for terrorism. It's mostly in Islamic countries, it's an Islamic state as well. Yeah. Like Pakistan, there's been a lot of problems in these Islamic states, largely because they've been being destabilised by the West, like people like Henry Kissinger doing it. But what's the reason for there being terrorist attacks in Indonesia now?
Well, the current one, I imagine, do you remember there was an attack on a Hindu temple in Thailand? That was carried out by Uyghur terrorists, according to the Thai police, who are basically anti-Chinese, pro-Western, aligned with the Turkish grey wolves. Now, that's, again, I'm skipping around from place to place here, but ISIS terrorism is now being used as a general excuse for Western military and political intervention in countries all over the world. Isn't it bizarre that ISIS just popped up like a rash everywhere? They attacked in Canada, in Australia, etc. and so forth. And of course, the suspicion has got to be that all of these attacks are being orchestrated by NATO.
Well, you say that, but it's ISIS that's claiming responsibility for the attack in Jakarta this week.
Yes, but who is ISIS? This is the whole point. I mean, the Russian general staff are pretty convinced that virtually everything that ISIS does is being run by NATO intelligence services. If you check online, you will see General Ivashov, who used to head up the Russian Russian military, he's fairly clear about this. They don't shout about it too much because they're trying to do deals with the West.
A couple of points.
But they're fairly clear on what their position is.
A couple of points in the background here, which are not really being put out on places like Newsnight, where they should be, is Indonesia's been defying US press to join Washington's proxy conflict with China in the South China Sea. And also, the Indonesians have been fostering closer economic and military ties with China itself.
Well, that will probably be the explanation. I mean, obviously, we can't jump to any conclusions because we don't have all
but
the
details.
But
there are some geopolitical things going on in the background.
Yes, most of this terrorism, people have got to understand it. It's being used in order to manipulate public opinion, in order to justify interventions, which are really about the geopolitical struggles between China, Russia, Iran on one side, and the NATO oligarchy on the
one of the places you find this kind of thing described is on the Land Destroyer blog. It's landdestroyer.blogspot.co.uk, and what he's saying there, I think it's Tony Cartolucci, is it was also a warning to Jakarta that it has a choice: subjugation by the West or destabilisation. Is it that simple?
Yeah, I think Cartolucci is he's based in Thailand. And he did a very good analysis of the bombing of the Hindu temple, because they say the Thai government, the new Thai government, is trying to become more friendly to China. They think it's in their interests to develop a good relationship with China. But I mean, what happens then if you start doing things which the Western puppet masters don't like? Then suddenly this Islamist terrorism begins to appear in your country.
But if
that's a message to those who can
if ISIS
read it.
Claims responsibility, there are no longer any questions by any of the London press or New York press or, you know, any of the major Western media about who's done it.
Well, that's because the Western media are part of the whole propaganda exercise that's being run.
How would you compare this to the troubles in Northern Ireland, where the IRA would claim a bombing attack? Of course, people would believe them, wouldn't they?
Well, that's because the IRA was a genuine organiser, heavily infiltrated by British intelligence, but an independent organisation. ISIS is effectively a puppet organisation of other forces. That's why it's able to continue operating in the Middle East with... You know, it's basically got sponsors and backers. And the sponsors and backers, I mean, the Russians are threatening to expose everything they know about this. And that in actual fact you have been backing these people and then saying, oh, well, I'll have to intervene in order to try and sort them out. Can you see how this works? The rash of Islamist terrorism all over the world gives the Western powers carte blanche to intervene. I mean, Obama's State of the Union speech, he was basically trying to prod the Congress into just give us a blank check to intervene wherever we need to intervene in order to fight this terrible threat. But this terrible threat is, in fact, of course, orchestrated. And it's not orchestrated by bin Laden.
Okay, let's go back to Ankara again. Turkish artillery attack ISIS targets in Iraq and Syria. It does seem as if the Turkish government, NATO, effectively involved in this, is insisting that it can do what it wants in Iraq and Syria. Now they've got porous borders, not only of various terrorists been going backwards and forwards across those borders, but also now the Turkish army is rolling out.
Well, I mean, what the Syrian government, Iranian government, Russian government position on this is you are pretending to attack ISIS targets. You are, you know, and basically we have evidence to suggest, for example, that in the beginning of the bombing campaign by the Western coalition in Syria, ISIS were warned to leave various buildings before they were attacked. And it's a very murky world out there. You've got all these different groups operating. Many of them, I don't think there's any doubt about the fact that the Saudis are backing these groups, for example. The Saudis are our allies. They keep Filton in Christmas money. And ultimately, we are involved in creating this chaos. And then everybody wants to go and have a nice cup of tea. Maybe that's not going to be the case.
Iran has affirmed this week also the core of its Iraq nuclear reactor has been removed, so we're getting closer and closer to a solid deal, really, between the US. John Kerry, I suppose, will be a feather in his cap come the end of the Obama administration, and Tehran and Washington.
Yes, and others who don't want to see that happen. The Saudis, the Israelis, and elements within the US intelligence and military establishment, all the Republican candidates in the presidential election. They've got a very vested interest in sabotaging it.
And this came up at Prime Minister's Questions this week. Was brought up by Seema Kennedy, this Iran nuclear deal.
Seema Kennedy!
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Yeah. Implementation
implementation of the Iran nuclear deal, in which British diplomacy was crucial, is imminent. Can my right honourable friend inform the House what steps are being taken to ensure that Iran abides by its side of the deal?
Well, I think my honourable friend is absolutely right about this. Let me pay tribute to Secretary of State John Kerry for the incredible work that he did, but also the Foreign Secretary, who was by his side all the way through negotiating what is a very tough and difficult deal. Where we've got to is that the adoption day for this deal was in October, and since then Iraq has started shipping 12.5 tonnes of enriched uranium to Russia. Now we're getting close to what is called the implementation day for this deal for this deal. And the key point is that Iran has granted the International Atomic Energy Agency unprecedented access to make sure it is doing all the things that it said it would do in this deal. As I said at the time, it's a good deal. It takes Iran away from a nuclear weapon, but we should enter into it with a very heavy heart and a very clear eye and a very hard head in making sure this country does everything it said it would.
Well, I mean, the whole debate has been ridiculous, really. There's been no evidence that Iran has been developing a nuclear weapon. None whatsoever. All the US intelligence agencies were absolutely clear when they were asked their opinion several years ago. There's no evidence that they're trying to develop a nuclear weapon. It doesn't make any sense for them to develop a nuclear weapon. They could never use it anyway. So, in a sense, this whole thing has been about isolating Iran.
What do you mean they could never use it? Of course they could.
How could they use it, Tony?
Well, they would use it if they were attacked themselves. It's one of those whole businesses. You use that weapon as a bargaining chip, don't you? Especially if you're talking to the Israelis, who've got hundreds of nuclear weapons.
Well, indeed. So the real problem is the Israelis, isn't it? It's nothing to do with the Iranians. The Israelis, we know, have over 200 nuclear weapons entirely illegally. Isn't it about time that the West either said to the Israelis, you get rid of those nuclear weapons, which you stole from us anyway, because Jonathan Pollard has just been released, who was the Israeli spy at the top of the US Navy, who gave the Israelis all the US nuclear secrets, which the Israelis then sold to the Soviet Union for various things that they wanted, including a free exit for Jews to Israel. The real threat, nuclear threat in the Middle East, is the only nuclear power in the Middle East, which is Israel, who hasn't signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, in complete defiance of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and in actual fact should then be, under existing US law, should be cut off from all aid, trade and support. But they haven't been. And if the Iranians were developing a nuclear weapon, you would be right that they would be justified in doing so. But there's no evidence that they have. They realise that that would be pointless because it's just provocative and it doesn't achieve any goals. They realise that if the Israelis were to nuke them without provocation, then it's unlikely that everybody else would just walk by on the other side of the road. It's the same happened with Britain. If we didn't have any nuclear weapons and somebody nuked us, that wouldn't be the end of it, would it?
Ultimately, do you think we're going to be seeing this deal in the next few weeks with Iran and... It's an Islamic state, and it seems a bit strange that obviously the Iranians and the Saudis don't get on very well, but we are trying to make friends with them all.
We're not trying to make friends with them all. We're basically still hostile to the Iranians. This deal has come about because the Iranians have just been very, very firm, and they've made it impossible for the other side not to come to some arrangement with them. That's what's happened here. They've basically given the International Atomic Energy Agency went with a fine tooth comb through what was going on in Iran, and they were absolutely clear they're not developing nuclear weapons. And finally, the Israelis, who are really pushing this, and the Saudis, have had to just swallow the deal because there's nothing else to do. But the whole thing is a diversion, and what we're really talking about here is the struggle for geopolitical hegemony between Israel and its allies and including Saudi Arabia and the West and the so-called resistance bloc.
Okay, let's end on Saudi Arabia, because this week there's been more condemnation of the bombing in Yemen, although more licences being signed for arms shipments by Philip Hammond, and there's talk also of British forces actually being in Saudi Arabia helping with the targeting and things in the Saudi bombing campaign.
Quite likely. British military personnel who expect to come back home to the... probably got their kids in private school here. They probably expect to come back here and have a pension. They are involved in the killing, the outright killing of thousands of civilians in Yemen. And, of course, they're also trying to starve the country, which has got 90% dependence on imports for its food supply. It's a war crime of the highest order being carried out by an autocratic dictatorship that should be forthwith overthrown, and we are involved in it. We are involved in it.
Well, between...
And if somebody were to come back and, for example, assassinate... If there are US or British military personnel in Saudi Arabia and some patriot comes up behind them in the middle of the night and blows their head off, who can weep a tear on that? Who can weep a tear?
Apparently between 90 and 95% of the casualties in Yemen have been civilians, and yet Philip Hammond says that that is just an accident and that there is no deliberate targeting of civilians, therefore it's not a war crime.
Well, I think that just shows how hypocritical the British are, doesn't it? And, of course, we've also been destabilising Syria. We repeated it many times. Roland Dumas, the French foreign minister, pointed a finger. He's been on French TV saying, I was approached by British officials who said, we are going to run an armed uprising in Syria. That means that people who are employed by us, with our taxes, are involved in mass murder in Syria and in Yemen. What are we going to do about it?
The point being, there's no contrition from Philip Hammond at all on these issues.
No, none whatsoever. They only understand one kind of language, don't they? And that's military defeat. And they've been defeated in Afghanistan. They've been defeated
in
Iraq.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Now, they're charged with keeping London's financial district safe from terrorists. The terrorists, we're told, are flooding across from Syria, conducting terrorist attacks right across Europe and, of course, possibly here in Britain. But with this week's announcement of a doubling of armed anti-terror officers patrolling the streets, wouldn't you have hoped the City of London Police Counter-Terrorism Command were up to the job? Well, earlier this week, I spoke to a victim of the London Police, City of London Police Counter-Terrorism Command. His name's Ian Puddick, who had a pretty awful time after he reported, or he was reported, for having a word with somebody who was trying to get his wife shifted during her office because she was having an affair with someone there. Anyway, Ian Puddick here now talking about Kroll private security firm, who appeared anyway to be giving the London Counter-Terrorism Command police their orders.
The managing director of Benedict Hamilton, in a statement actually, before my trial, I got an anonymous phone call telling me that I'd messed with the wrong people, that they had deep pockets and they were going to F me like I'd never been F before. Now, I have no... And when that call, it could have been one of my mates teasing me at the time, I was all paranoid. It's pre-trial. I had absolutely no idea where that call had come from until I got a police statement from the CPS from Benedict Hamilton, and he says, I purchased a clean phone, which is basically a euphemism for a pay-as-you-go phone that, you know, if you put a fiver on it and chuck the SIM away. And he said, I phoned Mr. Puddick and told him we warned him that he had deep pockets. So, I mean, at my trial, my barrister was able to say, look, you know, Mr. Puddick was the guy receiving the threats here. You know, we're going to F you like you've never been F before. And I have to say, he did keep his promise. I mean, they completely wrecked my life at the time. Well, they tried to. They did everything they could.
So let's talk a bit more about your business and your personal life and how that was affected by all this.
Well, my personal life, everything went on to hold. I mean, my business at the time was turning over £1.5 million. And I was so angry with what the police had done to me. When they brutalised me in that room at Snow Hill Police Station, when I complained they wiped the CCTV and the officers said they didn't deny roughing me up, they just said they couldn't remember. And when we got to my trial, the judge said to me, and I told the judge about all the things that the police had done to me and why I felt that I should go out to public. And I put banners up on... I put my website... I bought 20-foot banners, and I put them on every single... This is not an exaggeration. I put them on every single road bridge on the M25 and the M23 going down to Brighton. And as they came down, I put them up again just to get my website, policeexpenses.co.uk, out there. And I just said to the judge, that these guys swear enough to uphold the law, and then they just go and do whatever they want. And I just said, I'm not going to let them get away with it. You know, I was so upset. I walked out the station... when they roughed me up in tears. I'm a big guy. I was frightened. It's the first time in my life as an adult I'd been frightened. As a child I'd been frightened loads of times. But, you know, when you say to people, when were you last frightened? I don't mean anxious, scared or a bit intimidated. I mean frightened. It's not an emotion that you generally experience as an adult. And I came out of there completely out of my comfort zone from the public servants that we pay to protect us in tears.
Well, somebody has said to somebody, put the frighteners on him.
Yeah, and it worked. It was the guys at Kroll. The guys at Kroll's. I mean, my barrister in a recent TV interview said that, you know, Kroll, in the interview, he says Kroll were running the show. They were running the case. They were sending emails to the police, telling the police what to do. At my trial, the judge was appalled, and she actually stopped my trial at the end, just before the end. And she said, I want those two police officers, who weren't part of the case at this point. She said, I want those two officers here within an hour, the two officers that had roughed me up in custody. The first officer walks in, my barrister's firing questions him. He just has complete amnesia, cannot remember a thing. The second officer, Sergeant Ellis, who roughed me up in custody, he says, yeah, I remember taking Mr. Puddick into that room at Snow Hill Police Station. I've just remembered what it was all about. While I was searching Mr. Puddick's property, I'd found a large quantity of crack cocaine. So I'm behind bars in the dock for my stupid website, which I very proudly created. This guy's in the witness box, lying through his teeth. I shouted out, the judge told me off. I was so angry, I called him a liar. And my barrister said, so where did you find the crack cocaine? And he said, I found the crack cocaine in the kitchen, in the bedroom, and in the loft room. So my barrister said, so it was really a large cachet of crack cocaine. And he said, yeah, that's correct. And he said, and what else did you find? He said, I found all the paraphernalia. And he went into detail describing all the paraphernalia that he also found. And my barrister just took a completely different tact and just said, how many officers were searching Mr. Puddick's property? You're in charge of that search of Mr. Puddick's property. How many officers were there? He said, due to the passing of time, I can't remember, the old amnesia nonsense. And my barrister said, you're in charge. They were there with you. You must know who was there. And he kept trying to get out of it. My barrister said, was it one or two, maybe three? And he said, I just can't remember. I think it was around those figures. So my barrister read off a whole load of names, and we got to about 12, 13. The judge intervenes and says, how many officers were there, Sergeant Ellis? And then it turned out there were more. So he made a complete mockery of himself. So then my barrister said, okay, so you're in the kitchen. You found the first collection of crack cocaine. You've now discussed it with the other officers that were with you. And he went, no. He said, but you had to have discussed it with them. You found the crack cocaine. You've got other officers standing next to you. They'd be in my flat. They would have been bumping into each other. So he said, no, I didn't discuss it with them. He said, but you made a little note in your notepad. And he said, no, I forgot. He said, but you confiscated it. He said, no, I didn't. And I kid you not, I'm not making up. So my barrister said, okay, we understand that. You're under a lot of pressure. You're under a lot of pressure. You forgot to take the crack cocaine. He was mocking him. He said, now we move into the bedroom. You found the second lot of cachet of crack cocaine. You know what I'm going to say. He forgot to tell the officers. He forgot to make notes. And he forgot to confiscate it. So we then get to the third installment. My barrister says, and okay, we move to the loft. And then my barrister said to him, did you confiscate anything at all from Mr. Puddick's property? He said, yeah, we took his mobile phone, his tablet, his iPad, a digital camera and a computer. And my barrister said, what did you do with those? He said, we sent them all off to the high-tech crimes laboratory for forensics analysis. And he said, and did you find any evidence of any criminality on having forensically analysed any of those things? And he said, no. He said, okay, so we got to the loft now. So you found the third cachet of crack cocaine. Don't tell me you forgot to take it because you were busy confiscating the computer, the laptop, yeah, all this kind of stuff. And he just said, yeah, he'd left it all there. So the crack cocaine, technically, is still in my house. But what was really telling, and this is where Kroll come back in, 3 months before my trial, my house was broken into, my flat, my property was broken into, and they stole all my court defence papers. Now, what was interesting, I had a box with all of my court papers on it and my iPad. They lifted the iPad off and just stole the box of court defence papers. Now, in my property, I've got a unique piece of art by Damien Hirst. It's about £1,000. It's in a clear Perspex box. That was in my property 3 months before. Whilst giving evidence, Sergeant Ellis described that piece of art. But he wasn't in my That was there when my home was burgled. Mr. Ellis hadn't been into my property for a year and a half before that. I hadn't bought that piece of art then. So he was there a year and a half before I'd bought that art. So how was he able to describe a piece of art that was in my home that wasn't there when he was there, hadn't bought it yet?
Martin, sounds certainly as if Kroll quite making most of the running here in this operation. I mean, Ian has managed through the court process and through a very good barrister to make sure that all these charges against him have been dropped. But still, the point remains, Counter-Terrorism Command have got police officers there who appear certainly on the face of it to have lied in court, to have perjured themselves, and yet still nothing's being done about that kind of thing.
Well, I think the fact that it's counter-terrorism officers is extremely significant. We're not just talking about common run-of-the-mill corruption here. The counter-terrorism officers are supposed to be dealing with terrorism, not trying to fit people up for crack cocaine. And it just shows you that the people can't be allowed to have extra powers because they abuse them. And we had a case not long ago I think it was in Northumberland, where the counter-terrorism legislation was being used to target internal dissent within the police force, including the police federation, elected head of the police federation up there. In other words, these powers, which people think, well, powers against terrorism, that's never going to affect me. But once these powers are on the books, they can be used for anything. And that's why they shouldn't be on the books.
More importantly,
we've got perfectly good laws against terrorism without anti-terrorism laws.
Abused, yeah. Also, the interface here between the police and the private security firm Kroll, the City of London Police and Kroll, one does suspect things like revolving doors, the same sort of thing that's been going on between the financial regulators in the city and the banks.
Well, yes, and it's possible that the Kroll and the City of London Police are connected to criminality in the banks. That wouldn't be at all surprising, would it? Because that's how organised crime works. It corrupts the police force as a major goal. And, of course, it may well be that a lot of what's going on around us is being orchestrated by criminal groups who'll go right to the top in our society.
Well, in Metropolitan Police, Operation Tiberius, that was a report that came out in 2002, was only made public, that the fact that it had even been this report was leaked to the press, I think it was to Channel 4 News' Andy Davis in 2014. This was looking into lots of the connections within public services and outside being to do with Freemasonry. So I put this to Ian Puddick, but he was saying, actually, no, Freemasonry not necessarily involved. So let's have another listen now to Ian Puddick from this interview. And if you want to hear the full interview, it's on dialectradio.co.uk. It used to be here on BCFM, but it's been suspended. Hopefully back soon. If you want to hear the whole interview with Ian Puddick, it's www.dialectradio.co.uk. But here's another excerpt from that interview I did earlier this week about really looking at if anything Freemasonry has anything to do with it.
I mean, I hear all the stuff about Masons and they're all being, they're all on, everyone's on dodgy handshakes and money, and, you know, do those things happen? I'm sure they do. The reality in my case is it's more to do with revolving doors. For example, statistically, a lot of senior officers from City of London and the Met go to companies like Kroll, where they work as consultants after they've
retired.
Is
there more like Kroll that we should be keeping our eyes on?
Well, there are, but Kroll are the big boys. I mean, for example, Kroll launched something called Operation Martin against me, something I was able to get as part of my disclosure. They got a high court order. This is Kroll, not the police. They were able to get my personal bank details, to get my business bank details, to get copies of my telephone records, and to get the content of my emails and texts. And the reason they did that, they did an ex parte hearing with a high court judge. So that means Kroll go to court without me being notified, so I can't stand there with a lawyer and say we need to question this. And they did that by saying that Guy Carpenter, the reinsurance company, are the world's largest aviation reinsurer, and they are getting a terrorist unknown threat against them, and we've been brought in, so we don't want to get this into public because of aviation and terrorism, and the judge granted the order on the basis of that, of their lies. And they said there were significant and substantial threats against employees of Guy Carpenter, the insurance company.
Well, obviously, I mean, we could look at that and say, well, it wasn't true. So well, is there any...
Well, we've got an email from Benedict Hamilton, an internal email, saying what they said and stating, yeah, it's not true. Well, there isn't. So in his own
email... I mean,
email,
that's some sort of, at the very least, perjury... of some sort, isn't it?
Well, I'm a crack cocaine dealer. What would you expect? I mean, the whole thing is based on a tissue of lies by the police and these security.
So, yeah, but I mean, ultimately, if people do tell lies in those situations, they're themselves perverting the course of justice. Yeah, or it could be for a police officer, misconduct in public office. These are all very serious criminal offences.
Yeah, nobody...
Misconduct in public office, I think, I'm right in saying, is up to life in prison.
Yeah, but who's gonna honestly investigate it and take action?
I suppose there's this other side of things, which is... The state doesn't want to ever find itself guilty, isn't there?
Well, the state protects the state. That's the problem. So, for example, a good example of police corruption and how the police deal with it is Detective Chief Superintendent Tony Lundy. There was, a World in Action documentary. And cut a very long story short, some FBI wiretaps informed Scotland Yard that in 1986, £100 million worth of cocaine was coming in to the UK. That's in 1986. The wiretaps from the FBI picked up that the crooks or the baddies had a mole or someone helping them at Scotland Yard that was going to make sure that the drugs could get to where they need to be away from the police. They did an internal investigation, found out it was Detective Chief Superintendent Tony Lundy, and he retired on in ill health and received an enhanced police pension, not a normal police pension. He got an enhanced police pension.
And so did he get a knighthood?
No, he got he was taking £100,000 a year cash in bungs from the crooks.
That's Ian Puddick there, and you can hear the full interview at dialectradio.co.uk on the podcast. Martin, the whole process has been a massive education for Ian Puddick, and he's met a lot of other victims of police mistreatment in London. But really, the big story here, I suppose, is the explosion in the size and the extent of private security firms like Kroll.
Indeed. And, you know, we've now got a privatised security industry, which is indirectly funded by the taxpayer, but not accountable to the taxpayer.
Now, 4 or 5 years ago, I can remember seeing on the Blackwater website, this is the private military company, Blackwater, a little icon on there saying that they could help you fight a nuclear war. I mean, aren't things getting a little bit out of hand? Privatisation of nuclear war, privatisation of the sorts of security that's going on here, where a private firm can go to court and just get vast amounts of your private data without actually just through lying. You don't know it's going on, so it can't be tested in court.
Well, we're not just talking about bad apples here. There has been a systematic attempt to pervert the course of justice going back decades. We know for a fact through investigations by the Italian police, for example, that NATO intelligence services are terrorists. Every bit as terrorist as something like the Provisional IRA. Every bit. Absolutely no distinction to be made. In fact, the Provisional IRA probably got some more scruples than they've got. And this is the reality that middle-class England that listens to Radio 4 needs to get through their heads. NATO intelligence services, CIA, MI6, are not the good guys. They never were, they're still not.
Going back a little bit to a story we were dealing with earlier, and Prime Minister's questions again now, because we were talking about the low price of oil, and I was a bit disappointed really that there never seems to be anybody in the opposition parties that really asks the tough questions about the financial system, commodities markets, and that sort of thing. So it was Sir Alan Duncan who put this question to David Cameron about the falling price of oil and the possible ramifications of it, which shows that the Conservative Party in some ways seem to still understand the financial services industry much better than many of the other parties.
Sir Alan Duncan!
Yeah. Mr. Speaker, $30 oil is great for petrol prices, but it is potentially catastrophic in other respects. If it goes on like this, we risk seeing regimes under pressure, dramatic corporate failures and financial default, enormous financial transfers out of our markets to pay for other countries' deficits, a possible collapse in share prices and dividends for pensions, and a liquidity problem in our banking sector. May I invite the Prime Minister to initiate an urgent review across Whitehall to assess the effects of continuing low oil prices on our economy and beyond, and in particular, work out how we can avoid the destruction of our own oil industry in the North Sea.
So my right honourable friend makes an important point, which is this very big move in the oil price. Of course, it has a highly beneficial effect for all our constituents who are able to fill up their cars for less than a pound a litre, and that is a very big increase in people's disposable income, and wholly welcome. And I think a low oil price basically is good for the British economy, as an economy that is a substantial manufacturing and production economy. But of course there are other consequences, and he named many of them, and we need to look very carefully at how we can help our own oil and gas industry. Of course, as we're coming to the end of Prime Minister's questions, he did actually mention one other calamity that the oil, low oil price brings about, which is it has led to a complete and utter collapse of the SNP's policy.
Well, a cheap jibe at the end there. The oil price collapse is not the cause of the financial crash that is coming. It's a symptom of the collapse of effective demand in the global economy. The quantitative easing policies and basically allowing the big, too big to fail banks to continue in operation after 2008 has led to a situation where we're on the brink now of a major collapse and then Conservative MPs realise that there's going to be a major collapse. So what Duncan is doing there is he's blaming it on the oil price rather than on the financial sector itself. It's the shenanigans within the financial sector which have led to the collapse in global demand, which has led to the collapse in the demand
I just
for oil.
He's sounding a little bit like you, Martin, in a way, saying, well, yeah, look, this could happen. I mean, of course, we know that the liquidity was a massive problem that caused the bailout in 2008, and it looks like we're heading in that direction again.
Some
say that 1929, well, that was another liquidity was a big cause of the 1929, the real crash in 1929.
Well, this crash will make 1929 look like a Sunday afternoon tea party, Tony. And if, I think it's very significant that RBS this week was saying, sell everything, there's going to be a crash. George Osborne the other week was saying, well, actual fact, the British economy faces all these headwinds. What's going to happen when the crash comes is various people are going to say, aha, we knew this was going to come. Duncan will stand up and say, oh yes, well, I spoke in the House of Commons and I predicted there would be a crash. Now, that's not what he was telling his constituents when he said, vote for me last May, was it?
Well, you're quite right. RBS are saying exactly that. Sell everything ahead of a stock market crash. Royal Bank of Scotland is warning of cataclysmic year with slumps in shares and oil, and advises clients to shift to bonds. What's the difference?
A share, you can lose all your money. A bond, in theory, bonds can be issued by governments but you've got no voting rights or whatever. So what he's really saying is basically buy US treasuries, probably, is what they're really
he's also
about.
Saying, they're also saying, in a crowded hall, exit doors are small.
Yeah, well, what can happen is when a crash happens is you want to offload, you know, you're prepared to take some losses to get out of the market, but then you can't actually sell for any price at all. The markets overshoot. They don't just come back to a lower price, they overshoot on the downside, pulling down potentially viable industries in the mayhem. And I think that's where we're going now. I don't think there's any doubt about that, but nobody talked about that at last May's general election, least of all Conservative MPs. What should have been discussed at last May's general election is, was going to be a crash, what we're going to do about it. Who was talking about it? Nobody.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Change of tack again, coming back home to here in Bristol. And as I said earlier on, we were going to hear a bit from Christine Townsend, who's also standing as a candidate for mayor in the forthcoming mayoral elections in May this year. I spoke to her on the Dialect programme, and she's talking here about unofficial and official merchant venturer schools. So although we've got two merchant venturer schools, that's the Merchants Academy and Colston Girls School, there are others too, and so let's have a listen to what she has to say about that.
The secondary ones that they are officially running is Colston Girls' School and Merchants Academy. But they've also got a chair of governors that are merchant venturers at the City Academy and the Bristol Cathedral Choir School. And those four secondaries were in something called the Southwest Academies Division. And all of those schools have also now got their feeder primaries or their primaries that are attached to them. So the Colston Secondary's got the largest number of primaries. So they've got Dolphin School. They've got the new one that's just opened in the old Fairfield site in Montpellier, called, I think they've called that Fairlawn Primary School. They've taken over St Anne's Primary School down in St Anne's. The Cathedral Secondary School has got their feeder at their Cathedral Primary School in the basement of our central library. Merchants have taken over a primary school down in the south. They're also opening a special school for children with autism.
But what about the performance? Are they actually educating children properly?
Well, if you look at their headline GCSE figures, yes. You know, Colston does very well. The Cathedral does very well. But what you need to look at are the nuances between, how do their disadvantaged groups do? How many children are these schools excluding? And by that, I don't mean just permanently excluding when they get in through the door, but who are they excluding from actually getting in through the door? I mean, Cathedral have got less than 7% of their children on free school meals. Colston Girls have got just over 12%. The average in the city is 25%, and they're higher in the immediate surrounding areas, given where those two schools are located.
Because the problem here is that, I mean, if you can pick and choose who you want to educate, you're bound to come up with good results.
Exactly. And I'm going to suggest that that's exactly what certain schools in the city are doing.
So that was going back in a way to our conversation, Martin, with Afzal Shah in the first hour about selection. But what Christine's saying there is a little bit sinister in a way. She's saying, well, there are official merchant venturer controlled schools, but then there are also unofficial ones where merchants are centrally involved as governors, etc.
Well, that's because we haven't got a properly run education system based upon a fair allocation of resources to develop the capacities of all pupils from whatever background and ability. We've given up on that. It's now a free-for-all, where those with the sharpest elbows get the most resources, and devil take the hindmost.
Well, the sinister side to this, of course, is the history of the merchant venturers being slave traders, and, of course, being behind the reconnaissance trip of John Cabot over to North America, Newfoundland, being involved in the founding of some of the big cities certainly sowing the seeds for it. And a few weeks ago on the Dialect programme, I spoke to local poet Lawrence Hu about the Bristol slave traders, old and new.
Right, see him, John Cabot, another well-known person to Colston. Then you've also got John Hawkins, who... the first ships that went out and transported people was through him. He's got his own school not far out of Bristol, which is quite funny because I worked at Kumba, Artist in Residence, an Afro-Caribbean centre in the middle of St. Paul's. Once a year, pupils from John Hawkins School come down to watch a performance. And if you actually looks up John Hawkins' coat of arms, you will see enslaved people in his coat of arms. But until you go to record the other version of events, history is usually like just the victor's story. So when you think, in all honesty, the slave trade created the greatest Holocaust and annihilation of indigenous peoples on the planet. But you think it was North America, South America, Australia, all the Caribbean islands, and other places, Polynesia, all these places, these people were annihilated. I think Bristol was an incredibly large driver in the whole slavery movement. It built through it. If you actually look at a map of Bristol before slave trade, and then look at a map through those 300 years, and you actually see the incredible growth of the city, where did all that money come from? And if you look at where the most of the money came from, it came through the suffering of African people.
Nowadays, we've got still the merchant venturers still there. I mean, they go back to the 1500s. A little while after John Cabot, but then people will say, "Oh, well, actually, they were Bristol merchants that financed Cabot." Mm-hmm. Even if the merchant venturers formally were created afterwards,
adopted the person that we know as John Cabot. It's not his real name. He's Spanish, isn't he?
Ah, Cabotti, is
Cabotier.
It or something, yeah.
And his first name, I can't pronounce it. But it was funded by an Americano. I think his name was Americano. I can't remember.
Yeah,
I can't pronounce his proper name, but that's the person who actually funded his voyages. That's one of the funniest statements ever, isn't it? I've been a merchant venturer for 30 years. I'm going to go for mayor and I'm going to dissolve all my associations with the people that I've believed in for 30 years to take this job. Come on. It's a PR thing to say that he's no longer. Of course you're still a merchant.
Well, the other thing,
it obviously covered a name. It's control. Well, why would you want to relinquish control if you've had control? The original Round Templar Church, which was built about 1150, is there. And it predates the one in London. That's why we have temple meets. And I believe that was their base. Well, I think kind of with the Knights Templars, they kind of morphed from the Knights Templars, came to England, re-established themselves and kind of became the merchants. And I feel that's what the link is. And it's they then morphed in to become the group called the Merchant Venturers. Because they were chased out of Europe, weren't they, the Knights Templars, in the end?
Well, in France, certainly, yeah.
And, like, murdered as much as possible. So they had to reinvent themselves. I think people from all different ethnic groups need to come together because it's rich against poor. It's not ethnicities against ethnicities. There's a huge gap between what the haves have and what the have-nots have, and the have-nots have to stop looking at each other as different groups, which we're being programmed to do, and actually look at each other as one group. And the moment that happens, change can occur.
Lawrence Who there, his website, lawrencehwo.com. Time to sign off for the Wernock News at 7 o'clock now. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, Eastern Councillor for Labour, Afzal Shah. Our sister show, Dialect, you just heard an excerpt from it there, is online only now. Hopefully back on BCFM soon at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. This show's online, actually. All the archives at thisweek.org.uk. And I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. And don't let the banksters get you down.
And on your mobile.